Hi, everyone. Welcome to Diaspora Radio. My name is Arun Venugopal, and I am your guest host for this episode. And I'll be talking to Ginger Shankar. Ginger is a singer, virtuoso violinist, a composer, a model, and a songwriter, and she was born into one of the world's most acclaimed musical families. Her accomplishments are many. They include working with top movie producers and film composers like Mel Gibson, The Smashing Pumpkins, Trent Reznor, Mike Nichols, Mike Myers, and James Newton Howard. In addition to her film projects, she's also lent her voice and violin to several diverse projects ranging from soundtracks to electronic hip-hop. Most recently, she guested on Katy Perry's current album Prism on the single Legendary Lover. She's been in the studio working on her own debut album, Beautiful Imperfections, co-writing songs with Linda Perry, who's worked with Christina Aguilera and Pink, Sarah Dawn, Devin Barker and Parker, and Dan Crean. And she'll be touring this fall, more on that soon. An accomplished artist and performer, Ginger is the only female in the world, as I understand it, who has mastered the 10-string double violin, an instrument that covers the entire range of the orchestra's double bass, cello, viola, and violin, of which there are only currently two in existence, as I understand it. Coupled with her voice, which covers five octaves, the sound is unparalleled and unforgettable. I heard it myself, and I'll tell you a little more about that in a second. She debuted with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra as a soprano in Osvaldo Golijov's opera Einadamar, I hope I pronounced that right, and later performed it at Carnegie Hall. In addition to being the artist and co-composer behind the poignant score of Mel Gibson's blockbuster Passion of the Christ, Ginger's music can be heard on Mike Nichols' film Charlie Wilson's War. Her multimedia project Himalaya Song premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and was named one of the 10 best music films at Sundance by Rolling Stone. Her family project, known as Nari, will debut at the 2015 Toronto Film Festival. Welcome, Ginger.
Thank you so much.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. That was a really long bio.
Well,
I'm not sure how much time we have for this interview now.
Yeah. We'll just speak in like double time right now.
Exactly.
So I mentioned the double violin, which is one of your, I guess, your forte. I mean, you come from, as you mentioned, one of the most acclaimed and influential musical families. I vividly recall seeing El Shankar perform the double violin. This was at a concert in the early 90s. He was playing it with Zakir Hussain, and it was an extraordinary event and the first time I ever encountered this sound. I mean, this is the background you're coming from. Am I right? El Shankar is your family, correct?
Yes. Yeah, he is. My dad is El Subramaniam, the acclaimed violinist. The instrument's really, really incredible. It covers a whole orchestra range, and I used to travel a lot with the violin and viola and try to mic all these things at festivals, and it was really, really difficult. So I had this made by this incredible guitar luthier. So there's only two of them, and I sort of use it on all my projects now. I love the sound of it. It gives me so much versatility for live performance or soundtracks or anything.
Mm-hmm. So basically you came up, you were raised, where'd you grow up?
I went to music and dance boarding school in Kalakshetra growing up as a little kid. And then I was sort of raised between India and LA back and forth a lot of summers in India, a lot of school in both places, music in both places. So I sort of consider myself on both sides of that.
A child of the world.
Nomad, more like it.
A nomad. Okay.
Yeah.
So give me a sense of, I guess, you know, you were basically born to this musical culture. I guess you probably can't imagine a time when music wasn't being played around you.
That's absolutely true. I think I grew up with it. You know, before you could talk, you were singing and you were performing for people and you were at concerts and backstage. And it was just such a culture of growing up in that. I mean, falling asleep at Indian classical concerts when I was little. I think before I knew what it was, I think I was already a musician, because when you're around it all the time and only growing up and realizing like, oh my God, that person I was hanging out with was, you know, V.G. Jobe or Yehudi Menuhin or Stefan Grappelli, you're so lucky in that way. And I don't think I could have been anything else, really.
So is there an age at which you kind of had to make a choice whether to commit yourself in terms of this, doing this professionally, or was it just always assumed? Is it something you ever questioned?
I think at some point, I think my dad wanted me to be a doctor when I was growing up, but I don't think that was really ever in the cards. I mean, I read a lot of medical books as a little kid, and I could tell you a lot about it, but I definitely loved music. I was around it all the time, just seeing my family members on stage performing, traveling. It was something that I always really loved, so I don't think I could have done anything else.
Now, so you've basically been shuttling back between, I guess, the U.S. and India in terms of your where you've lived. Have you lived anywhere else?
I've spent quite a bit of time in London as well, yeah.
Okay.
But it's a little too cold for my taste.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the same for me in New York when it hits like October, November, but I really don't have much choice. I don't have the choice to be a nomad, really.
Yeah, New York winters are pretty tough.
I'm sorry?
I said New York winters are pretty rough. I try to avoid it as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess was there a time when growing up amidst all these amazing artists that you ever felt self-conscious about it, that it felt like daunting in some manner?
Absolutely. I think coming from, you know, my dad's side of the family is the Subramaniam family, and the mom's side is like the Ravi Shankar Uday Shankar family. So you can't really not have pressure on your shoulders, I don't think. I think there's some part of it that's an extreme gift because you're around so many amazing musicians, but it is really, really hard. For me anyway, it was really hard to sort of figure out where my voice is and what I wanted to do. And because you look around and you're like, well, I want to be like him. I want to be like her, and I want to sound like that. So I think it took me a while, and this is why I went through a lot of transitions of touring with rock bands and playing in operas and just trying to figure out sort of where I belonged in that. So that took me a while, but I definitely feel like now I've found my own voice in this.
Now, when we talk about these, broadly speaking, these, you know, traditions of, say, Western popular music and say, Indian classical, I mean, that kind of, those upbringings, I guess, I mean, there's a very strict and rigorous sort of training that's associated with Indian classical, very distinct from the way that people might enter into popular music in the West. And, you know, I mean, the aesthetic is considered very democratic. Anybody can become, say, an MC or, you know, it's a very different kind of experience. I mean, what was your experience in that sense? Were you kind of groomed very rigorously in one and then you just kind of branched off into others?
Yeah, I was definitely trained in South Indian music and North Indian music. Those were sort of my backgrounds growing up. But then also, my mom made me take a lot of classical piano lessons, so that was sort of the other side of it. But it was all very classical overall. And I think the reason I got into, you know, the more pop rock world is just because that was what I listened to growing up. I mean, we went to a lot of concerts, but I also listened to the radio, and I loved the Spice Girls, and I loved, you know, anything that was going on the radio. So that was always sort of in my brain. And I think growing up in both places, I think I was sort of a hybrid anyway. The way I write is very much influenced by everything I listened to and everything I was trained in. So going into, you know, the first band I toured with was the Smashing Pumpkins. So the really amazing thing is Billy Corgan, the lead singer, it was their 20th year anniversary. So he said, you know, do you want to do really interesting string arrangements and sing on like some of the songs that we've already done? So like I got to bring my background into that, which is really great. But then also playing with these amazing players, like we had the horn players from No Doubt. We had the original drummer from the Pumpkins. It was just an amazing experience to be able to play with these group of musicians and kind of get into the rock world that way. It was a really good training for me, I think.
Do you have an opinion about these two different kinds of ways of coming to music, the very sort of rigorous, kind of many hours a day sort of, I guess, experience of going to, say, Indian classical versus the much more sort of, personalized way of getting into, say, pop music? Do you think that it is important for somebody to have many hours of, you know, musical training, sort of the more conservatory approach or the gharana, or do you think that sort of can be stifling?
I know a lot of people, it's funny that even come to my shows that say, you know, I took up the violin when I was younger and I was like made to do it so much that I stopped and now I regret it. I think pushing somebody too much into it isn't a good idea either. But I do think if you're in any sort of music, you should know some instrument. You should know how to write. I think it would just enhance you as an artist. It's easy to sort of get into anything, but I think it is great if you know how to play the piano or know how to play some other instrument besides, you know, just getting into a type of music.
Were there times when you were, say, a teenager when you kind of rebelled and your you know, your mom or somebody else had to say, no, you're going to stick with this. I don't care.
Oh, absolutely. My grandfather used to be the one, like, I used to have to sit and play Carnatic violin with him every day after school, and I hated it at some point. It probably was, like, you know, 9 years old or 10 years old. And so I was such a nerd, so I wasn't rebelling in any other sort of way except that I would, like, lock myself in the bathroom, turn the shower on so I could sit there and I could read a book. And he would keep coming and knocking on the door being like, are you done? We have to play now. And I would just basically sit in the bathroom and, like, read books. And they finally caught me, so... That was the end of that. But yeah, I did not like it.
This is rebellion, the good Indian girl.
The Indian
way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I do find it funny that even you were not immune to the whole, like, you're going to be a doctor when you get older, sort of. So you mentioned Ravi Shankar. I mean, I guess as somebody who composes for film, I mean, I recently saw the first two films of his Apu trilogy, and I found it, I mean, it's not the first time I've seen these films, but I found it just literally emotionally overwhelming, almost incapable of, like, you know, going through it, because the combination of storytelling and the cinematography and, of course, the sound, which, I guess Ravi Shankar scoring the Satyajit Ray trilogy, it was so powerful. I mean, which of the films were those films that, you know, you kind of watch at a young age and learn from when it came to your own work?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny. I actually just saw the remastered versions, too. I think they showed it at MoMA a couple months ago, and I felt the same way. It was overwhelming. It was so beautiful. And, yeah, I mean, I grew up watching that. I mean, the Gandhi soundtrack, my grandmother sang on the Gandhi soundtrack. Ravi composed that. My dad composed, you know, Salaam Bombay, which I think is such an exquisite soundtrack.
Yeah.
So I definitely grew up sort of listening to this. None of them were really film composers. They were all mainly performers that did a film here and there, but it definitely stuck with me because even when my dad was working on Salaam Bombay and Mrs. Sala, we were around all the time and we'd hear this music and see it. And it was just, it was something that was always very interesting to me. I didn't think I ever wanted to be a film composer, but I just thought it was such an interesting medium that they were working in.
So what is the process? I mean, there's something sort of a little mystical about a film score. How does it, is it different with every project, or is there sort of a typical kind of routine going from, like, the first time you sit down with, say, the director to, you know, actually creating the sounds that become, you know, the score of a film?
For me, it's definitely been very different director to director. I mean, when I worked on my first film, Circumstance, I was given the script, and I started working from just reading the script and writing themes. And then on other films, you sort of come in with 6 weeks to sort of sit down and watch it and score all the music. And usually the way it works is the director will sit down with you and they'll have some sort of references of music and say, you know, we really like this because of this, or we like the sound of that. Can you create something along those lines? So it really depends. And music is such a difficult thing to talk about. So, you know, Happy to Me can be completely different Happy to You as far as music is concerned. So it was definitely a new experience for me to get into that, and it's still sort of, every director is very different, but it's so amazing to be inspired by a picture. It's such a different way to write. It's such a different way to think. So I really love doing that.
Okay, so you're listening to In Diaspora Radio. I am your guest host, Arun Venugopal, and we are speaking with Ginger Shankar. So Ginger, tell me a little more about this process of scoring a film. I mean, you can go for weeks actually working on themes and sort of moods, and then sometimes you sit down with the director and you have no idea with this director how they're going to respond to all this work you've done, correct?
Absolutely. It's definitely a scary. To me, starting a film is really hard because it's such a blank canvas. You're not really writing something for yourself. You're writing something very clearly for picture. You hope the director likes it. So it's a little scarier to me than performing on stage or writing music for myself. But once it starts coming together, it's pretty amazing. Because once you start establishing the themes and then you go from there, then you're in a studio recording orchestra and your, you know, music comes to life. It's a pretty extraordinary experience seeing the film, seeing how your music works with the film. I really, really have loved doing that sort of over the years, like different films and different processes and different musicians. It's been a great experience for me.
Now, it's funny for you to say that scoring a film is scarier than getting on stage and performing live in front of people, but So do you have, are you nervous when you get up on stage and perform, or is it something you've done so many times that you don't have any fear?
I definitely have butterflies. I think if you're not nervous and you don't feel sort of that excitement on stage, you shouldn't be performing. I think that's so part of it, you know, getting up there every day and getting in front of fans and getting in front of the, just knowing what the room feels like. I think that's so much a part of it. I think if I didn't feel anything going on stage, I definitely would not be performing anyway.
Do you think it's harder to be, I mean, like, there's so many distractions that can happen nowadays in any experience, whether you're sitting and watching a film and somebody starts talking on the phone or in any other kind of, you know, artistic event. I'm just wondering, do you as a performer find that the culture of performing has been sort of polluted or affected by, you know, those kinds of distractions, people trying to, you know, selfie themselves while, you know, they're at your show or just, you know, tweeting it out and not really just being distracted in ways?
Yeah, it's tough. It's funny because I think in a classical concert, you don't really find that. But definitely if you're doing like a pop show in a club, it's definitely, it's sort of, you need both, right? Like you need people to tweet about your show in the social media world. You need people to talk about it. But at the same time, you want them to pay attention. And like I noticed this more from going to shows. Like I always think it's funny how you see people on stage and people are basically looking at their phones, videotaping, you know, the stage. So nobody's actually watching the musician. They're watching their phone and making sure it's being recorded right. And I think that's really funny to me because you're sort of losing the experience of interaction with whoever's on stage. So that I think is a little funny. But
right.
It's really hard to say, like, we in the social media world as artists, like, we need that. So it's hard to kind of say, well, you can't tweet and you can't do these things because it is part of the experience now. But, yeah, it's a little distracting.
That is interesting. You loom, like, in your physical presence and your, you know, your full form in front of them, and yet they're staring at this 2-inch square little two-dimensional version of you.
Exactly. I've definitely been to a lot of shows where I've seen that, where every single person, you know, has an iPhone towards the stage or whatever their phone is, and they're looking at their phone. So there you go.
Do you find it different, the culture in India? Do you perform enough there or interact there enough that, or is it very similar to how people are here?
I feel like, I mean, I've played in Bombay and it's been a little bit since I've performed in Madras, but I feel like the culture is pretty similar. Everyone's definitely on their cell phones. Everyone's very social media savvy, and I think it's not quite that different. I think Indian classical concerts still, though, across the board, and classical concerts, Western classical, you don't see that as much, whether it's there or here, because it's much more seated, and you have to remain quiet, and you can't, you know. So I don't see the phone culture as much in that.
I'm curious. I remember a few years ago, I was in Madras and Chennai, and my aunt, who is a classical musician, and we were watching TV, and she said, you know, all these new shows, I mean, not that they're that new, but these sort of music competitions that are everywhere, and people are obsessed with watching them. And she said, you know, the problem is that these kids who get into them, they're kind of being prematurely sort of groomed. Their voices are really not ready. They feel like they're not getting groomed in the way that they should be, that the tradition demands. They're more just trying to get onto these competitions, and it's a bad thing. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how sort of like pop culture and that sort of notion of celebrity is affecting these sort of traditional systems.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. My grandmother, before she passed away, she used to teach a lot of students. She taught a lot of vocal, and she used to say that all the time because, you know, when I was growing up, I sound like I grew up in the 1920s, but when I was growing up, like we were not, like when I played the violin, you know, you played years of exercises before you played anything. When I sat down with my grandmother, it was vocal exercises. And her comment was, you know, these young kids now who want to be on these TV shows come in, and the first thing is, can you teach me a song? Can you teach me a song so I can perform it? And I think definitely some of the work ethic has gone away because of how quick everyone can become famous now, which is kind of a pity. But I think the musicians that are still the musicians are definitely shining through, because if you go to a show and you see someone who can actually play, then that definitely sets them apart, I think, from a lot of other people.
Right. So tell me about this project called Nari.
Oh, yeah. So basically it was conceived about a year and a half ago because my amazing grandmother passed away and she gave me all these scrapbooks. And I knew that her and my mother were involved in sort of this huge Indian music into the West, you know, explosion with George Harrison and Raviji. But I didn't sort of know how much. She kind of said, yeah, we played a little bit, we did these things. And then sort of looking through these scrapbooks, I realized that you know, my grandmother was conducting orchestras, and my mom and my grandmother were on every record cover, and they sang on everything, and they toured, and nobody sort of knew their stories, including myself. So it was about my partner in the project, Dave Liang, who's from the Shanghai Restoration Project, and I started working on the music aspect of it. We found these incredible recordings of my mother and started remixing them. And then Yunfan Sun, who's an amazing animator and director, came on board to help us with all the visual side of it. So we basically put this multimedia project together about the life of my mother and grandmother. So we went to India a lot and filmed where my mother grew up. And it's like the whole story of the women during this whole Indian music explosion and where they came from and their stories. So it's been an amazing journey and a very, very personal one, obviously. So it was very, very exciting that we got into the Toronto Film Festival with it. So we're going to be debuting it next month.
Oh, next month. And where is that?
In Toronto. It's during their International Film Festival.
Oh, okay. That's the world's biggest film festival, isn't it?
Yeah. No pressure.
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah, that sounds amazing. So your mother was, I think, was she? You said you have, I read that she had you have your mother's recordings from when she was just 19 years old. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, I mean, growing up, I knew her as my mother and, you know, someone who had, you know, three jobs and four kids and worked really hard, and she never really talked about that. And, you know, when she'd sing a song, you'd go, wow, she's incredible, but didn't really know anything more than that. Just knew that kind of, you know, she sang a little bit. And so when we found these recordings and realized, like, she really wanted to be a singer, and the family really didn't want her to be a singer. So she was sent to London to go to beauty school. And then after that, you know, she toured a little bit with them, but then got married. And just sort of this whole idea of her being an artist kind of disappeared with these recordings. So it was very important for me to work on them and make sure, you know, people hear them.
So have you, from, I guess, as an artist yourself, as a woman who's been involved in I guess, the business here in America, in London, in India, you've sort of experienced different aspects to the industry worldwide, and you've also sort of been doing this work as a historian and as a documentarian, looking at your own mother and your grandmother and their experience as women in music. Do you have any broad thoughts about, was it harder to be a woman then? Is it anything that's changed? Is it apples and oranges when it comes to being a female musician in the 1920s or the 1960s versus the 21st century?
Wow. I mean, I think my grandmother definitely grew up in a time where, you know, she was a South Indian girl, and being a dancer just wasn't acceptable. And her mother still made her study dance. And then she was discovered in the Uday Shankar dance troupe. She ended up, you know, supporting her entire family, her entire life. These are things that women didn't do then, you know, and my grandmother was very headstrong, very ahead of her time. So I think she had a really hard time, and I think my mother did too. And it's funny, the visual artist director, Yunfan Sun, who I'm working with, like, we really resonated on that so much about, you know, the plight of women and how hard they had to work to get where they are, but still so far that we have to go. I mean, look at our country right now, you know. Women's rights here, women's rights in India. I mean, it's a constant battle, whether you're a musician or anybody, really. So I think that is why, you know, this project is so important to me and to Yunfan and to Dave. I think it's sort of a bigger statement on women and, you know, how much they go through and how much they have to survive. And, yeah, it's a bigger story.
Do you think that
the other hour of our radio program?
Well, we do our best to put these into, I guess, slightly bite-sized sort of portions. But it is fascinating.
Exactly.
I mean, I it is interesting when you think about, like, you've been talking about just the different culture of experiencing music. But, you know, when I think about, say, the very more austere kind of experience of being, say, in Madras in the winter and going to a concert, and there's a certain kind of a dignity to the experience and to the performer, and it's very different from, you know, obviously from going to a popular concert here and the experience of being a woman, you know, whether it's, say, somebody like Miley Cyrus or somebody else who's trying, you know, who has to craft themselves in a very distinct way, and sometimes that can be fraught in its own way, you know, in terms of the feminist aspects of that. Do you think that the tradition of, you know, these more austere traditions of being Carnatic or Hindustani, that they in some ways protect, you know, a woman from those kinds of forces?
I don't think a woman is protected sort of in any of those ways. I think it's interesting you bring up Miley Cyrus. To me, it's funny because I definitely was not necessarily a fan of her music, but just sort of the platform she's on and what she's doing to sort of help women everywhere and LGBT and all these things, I think it's incredible. And I think, like, the idea of being austere and having to present yourself in a certain way is stifling in its own way, you know, because I think Indian classical concerts, I think, are incredible and the musicianship is incredible, but, like, the fact that you have to dress a certain way or act a certain way or be a certain way, I think, is its own sort of thing, you know, because I don't think the men are necessarily required to do that. I think the women definitely are. So, I mean, I think it's across the board. I think women in general, I mean, even look at the entertainment scene, how many conversations we've had about the fact there's not a lot of women directors, and there are definitely not a lot of women composers either. So it's an ongoing conversation, I think, about women in film and music and media and sort of what is required of them and what they need to be and what they, you know, I have a lot to say about that.
So. Surely. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us, Ginger.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, you've been listening to In Diaspora Radio. My name is Arun Venugopal, and I've been speaking with Ginger Shankar.
In Diaspora Radio has been produced by Monica Patel. The music is by Reena Ismail. And we'd like to thank our guest host, Mr. Arun Venugopal, and our guest, Ginger Shankar. So long, everyone.
Thanks.